Mainstream Mental Health Radio
with Dr. John Huber.
What do you think you are, crazy or something? Well, you're not.
We're on a mission from God.
News, issues revolving around mental health.
Dr. John Huber, a mental health professional for over 20 years, the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, a clinical forensic psychologist, and a psychology professor at Texas State University. Breaking the silence of mental health, one day at a time, discussing the human condition, providing a sounding board for mental health issues, and making mental health mainstream.
You got a gift, my friend.
Now it's time for Mainstream Mental Health Radio.
Let the healing begin.
With Dr. John Huber.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. John Huber. Thank you very much for listening. And please share our information, our radio show, with your friends and family. And you can follow us on mainstreammentalhealth.org. And download our shows on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio of Mainstream Mental Health. Again, thank you for listening. All right, today we got some interesting things going on. We continue with the struggle with cell phones and how they affect us and smartphones and screen time. And another study's out, and it doesn't look very good. Basically, teen depression rates have jumped 33% between 2010 and 2015, and during that same time, suicide attempts rose by almost a quarter in that group. In fact, another study that's out there says between 13 and 18 years of age, 32% in total attempt rate for suicide for that group. Now, this psychologist, Gene Twinge of San Diego State University, has sifted through various possible explanations and says only one factor explains the abrupt shift in American teens' mental health, and that is smartphones. Over that same period, the fraction of teens with access to smartphones rose to almost three quarters and has continued to rise. The pervasiveness of smartphones seems to cross all socioeconomic boundaries. In fact, in 2012, it was estimated that about 58% of teenagers between the ages of 13 and 18 had access to smartphones. By 2014, it was 73%. So the pervasiveness is extensive and real. So while internet access can be a positive thing, especially if you're isolated in a hospital or some things like that, Twin says the hours that teens are spending online and the constant presence of social media is taking a toll on young Americans' health and happiness. So by taking smartphones out of the hands of teens, the research suggests, isn't necessarily the answer. However, additional research that's out there has shown that if you take a week and actually go cold turkey off of social media, the research suggests that by the end of that week, you're already starting to show fewer signs of depression. So the problem is that initial drop of contact that really is difficult on a lot of people. So pay attention to what your kids are doing, and remember, smartphones are taking a toll on teens' mental health in general. So we have to ask then, are we a generation at risk? Well, Americans youngest facing mental health crisis definitely are looking at some significant risks we've never had before. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention reports that one in five American children ages 3 through 17, that makes up about 15 million people, have a diagnosable mental or emotional or behavioral disorder in any given year. And what we do know is that only one in five, so 20% of these children, are ever diagnosed and receive any treatment. 80% of these people, about 12 million, aren't receiving any treatment at all. Now, we know that evidence is pretty much across the board as adults. One in five, according to the CDC, of adults have a diagnosable mental health disorder, and only about one in four of those are actually getting help. So 75 to 80% of our population are getting no help for their mental health disorders, which is disheartening and scary. Recent research indicates that serious depression is worsening in teens, especially in girls, and suicide rates among girls reached a 40-year high in 2015. This is according to the CDC, and it was released in August, and then the story was reported again in today.com. So this cell phone screen time issue is significant, and it potentially has long-term ramifications in general, period. Now, psychology is something I like to see, and, you know, a lot of people in business are starting to utilize psychology and the information that we've learned through research and simple things like, you know, playing music at a certain rate or certain tempo. Music can increase buying habits and shopping habits. What we see though is that restaurants now are starting to use psychology to make you spend more money. They basically are influencing what you'd rather order. So they may focus on a $10 bowl of mac and cheese, or they'll switch the focus over to a $12 four cheese baked pasta topped with artisanal breadcrumbs, and essentially the same product, but you're paying $2 more for it. And they do it in different ways. Now, for most people, dinner is in the details, how you phrase things, placement, pricing, and other less obvious elements of presenting each dish in a menu may sway a meal order in certain ways that people aren't even conscious of. You know, that menu design, the first simplest way is, just putting things in an attractive manner and showing beautiful pictures of your food products. This design use and method of attracting your eyes is a great way to increase the frequency of orders of any particular item on your menu. If the menu focuses on it, it actually increases the likelihood that the diners will actually focus on it. Kevin Gregory, the creative director of All Day Industry, is a restaurant consulting firm in New York City, states that common techniques include using boxing of menu items or using lines to focus the eye on a certain area. So, you know, you have the general menu, and then you have your high-end, high-expensive items in a box, and you call them, you know, like this is your store specialty or your restaurant specialty, and people focus on that. And then they take a look at numbers. That's the second big thing they do. While the menu is essentially a price list, menu pricing strategies can actually convince customers to forget to consider the price of any specific menu item, period. So how they present it, framing, presentation, those will all help you make a decision, but they can help you make a decision that the restaurant owner would like you to make to spend more money. So the third thing is, when you're looking at a menu as a diner, stay away from anything that says it's our famous or it's our signature or it's our original, our specialty items. You know, using specific words and phrases encourage you to order certain items more frequently. And Kevin Gregory continues, and he says that something we see a lot of in the industry are items labeled with signature or famous or original. And these words help these items stand out and assert their position in as a more desirable item. And we order a simple item when you can have, you know, why order a simple item when you can have a signature or a special item for just a dollar or two more? So this was also online at salon.com. You can check it out. Article is titled Restaurant Use Menu Psychology to Make You Spend More Money, and follow up with that. So we've been talking about screen time and how that affects your mental health. And previously on Mainstream Mental Health Radio, we've listened and talked about some of the engineers and designers from Facebook and some other social media apps. Well, Facebook has a former vice president, and he has come out to say that at a talk he gave at Stanford Graduate School of Business recently, that will make you think twice about your social media use, and rightfully so. He says he personally feels a tremendous guilt about Facebook. He says, I think we have created tools that are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works. He says the short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops have created and are destroying how society works. He added, there's no civil discourse, no cooperation. It seems only misinformation and mistruth are spread through social media. And it's not an American problem. It's not a Russian problem, or it's not about Russian influence. It is a global problem, period. Now, I see this all the time. You know, people are stuck and they can't put down their Facebook. They can't put down Instagram, instant messaging. They can't put down Snapchat. They want to see what their friends are doing, and they want to like so that they get liked as well. So it is a never-ending, aggressive, reciprocal process that stems off of a dopamine feedback system. And they've created essentially another way to become addicted, and it's pretty telling. So, you know, on the face of this, I do agree with these Facebook executives and former executives that social media is having a significant and detrimental impact on society. At the same time, though, I believe the human race is resilient. I think we will get through this. And, you know, we made it through the Eagles. We made it through Elvis. We made it through the Beatles and, you know, all the people panicking and families saying how they're being destroyed and the world's going to end up in failure. Well, that didn't play out. In fact, you know, we've done some amazing things since the Beatles and Elvis. So, it's going to be an adjustment and we'll get through it. I really believe that it has changed and will continue to change our society and our fabric. But hopefully, with using examples like Elvis and the Beatles, I think we will get through this and our moral fabric will stay intact. I think social media has already changed the way people interact. Young people find it very difficult to make appropriate eye contact in actual face-to-face conversations. In business interactions, I talk with business owners all the time who complain because they have to teach sometimes college graduates how to answer a phone professionally because they're not getting it anymore with caller ID and social media texting and instant messaging. Those skills are going away. However, they're essential to running a healthy, productive business. So I think we're seeing changes and the business models having to change to deal with it. I think, our current information flow is not nearly as cyclical as it used to be. Now I think it is constant. It takes a break somewhat on some of the weekends. You know, it used to be if you watched, you know, your news and got it from our regular network television shows, you know, news on Friday was just kind of blasé and you didn't hear much about it, didn't pay any attention to it until Monday morning. So you had a break. You got away Saturday and Sunday from having to listen to this constant news. With our information today and how it just is always on, you never get a break. And if you're struggling, you're having a hard time at work, you're maybe being depressed, having anxiety, and just always hearing negativity, 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 I think it is very problematic unless you can find good positive reporters like Helena Hovitz, who we've had on our show and are glad to have. And, you know, that positive media attention is something that we need to start paying attention to and utilize. Just a reminder, you're listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. John Huber, and today we have an amazing guest. I've been really excited for the last couple of weeks to have her on, and she is an editor, a publicist, a writer. She is an advocate for mental health, and that's one of our big pushes here at Mainstream. And I would like to open the floor up and welcome Helena Hovitz. Hello, Helena.
Hi. How are you?
Well, I am amazing. And, you know, you have a lot of things going on, and we're entering into the holiday season. I think this evening Hanukkah starts, and a lot of people are out there, and they're going to be doing a lot of social things. And one of the things you've written about is how to deal with the pressures of, you know, not drinking during this time of year, or any time of year, actually. And could we just kind of start off with that, and then we'll move into the mental health stuff and talk about your book and everything else you're doing at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got sober young at 22, and I'm 28 now. And it can be, you know, whether you're a teenager or whether you're, you know, in your 40s or 50s, it can be kind of tough to refrain from drinking. And also when you're in a social setting, you kind of, everyone else, chances are most people are drinking. And it's pretty much an art to know and master how to, quote unquote, just say no, but in a very practical, adult, and real way. So the things that have worked for me, there are super simple tips. For example, get something that looks like a drink and hold it. So this way, you're not drinking, but also, like, it kind of looks like you are, right? So
right.
A regular Coke could be a pass for a Jack and Coke. Or last night I went to a holiday party and they said, can I have a seltzer and could you sprinkle some of those pomegranate seeds in it? Usually, though, nobody will – someone might say, oh, why aren't you drinking? And for me, I say, you know, I'm just not – you know, I might say I'm not feeling it tonight, but me personally, I'm very forthcoming about my status. So I'll be like, oh, I don't drink. And someone might be like, are you pregnant? Because people don't hold back. And I'll be like, no, I'm actually an alcoholic and I've been sober for 6 years. And people then, it's funny, people are so worried about what people will think when you say that, but people are usually like impressed and congratulate me.
Right.
And I'm like, thanks, I enjoy not being a hot mess. So my dog clearly wants to be part of the interview. That's another reason I'm glad I'm sober, because he is a very demanding dog and he needs all my attention. So the other tips that I would give are, you know, to think it through, right? If you are someone who is sober and you're thinking like, oh, I should really use a drink. The holidays are a stressful time, right? So really, what's going to happen after you have that first drink? Are you just going to have the one drink? Are you, like, fast forward in time, right? So chances are you don't wake up the next day like, oh, I'm so pissed that I didn't drink. Usually you're pretty happy about it. I would say also park yourself near the food.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the very first technique is using, you know, some other prop, essentially, you know, soda or a Coke or maybe even iced tea and walking around with it. You know, I work with a lot of patients who struggle with alcohol use, abuse, and addiction. And, you know, I get a lot of bartenders who come into my practice, and they have a hard time because their patrons will order them shots. You know, they'll buy them a shot. And it's kind of like if they don't do it, the patrons get upset. And so, you know, I've worked with a lot of them, and really simple things is they always keep an empty beer bottle next to the bar underneath, and they take the shot, and then they act like they're chasing it with the beer, and they're actually spitting a shot back in the beer bottle. And
smart.
Yeah, that way they don't get their customers upset because they depend on their tips, and they don't also get messed up like that, so.
Yeah, and I also, one thing I've heard is effective if it's a one-off thing is, oh, I'm on antibiotics, I can't mix with alcohol. Now, that is a great short-term solution. Obviously, if you work with these people and it's a holiday party and you're around them for 5 years, if you were always on antibiotics, I would be very worried about you. So that might be the time to just say, you know, I don't drink. And to me, that's a full sentence. I don't drink. I'm not drinking.
Exactly. Well, no. You know, if you want to use something like that, antidepressants and antipsychotic, most psychotropic medications are blocked by alcohol. The alcohol has an affinity for the receptor sites, so it keeps them from working. So if you're actually on those, you shouldn't be drinking anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say my other two big tips are, one, have a buddy that you check in with, whether it's in text or a phone right before or right after the event, because having that social support, even if it's just a text message, if you're somewhere where you can't hop on the phone, just have a text buddy. You know, it's really being accountable and having that buddy system in place is just so empowering, and it can really help you get through what feels just slightly uncomfortable in the short term. And the other thing is to limit your time too. You know, usually an hour is a fair amount, because by that time, you know, getting all the pictures, talk to everyone. This way, you've really made your presence known. And when you say, oh, I got to get going, chances are by then everyone's had a couple anyway, and they are as lovely as you probably are. They just probably don't care if you leave because they're doing their own thing. So those are my kind of my big ones. But again, like I've found that really owning it, like, yeah, I'm sober. People tend not to push. They really don't.
Exactly.
And if someone is really focused on why you're not drinking, I think that's a them problem. I think that's something that they would probably need to look at. Usually people are not invested in why other people are drinking unless they want to feel more comfortable with their own.
And they have a problem, yes. And most of those last two techniques give you a sense of accountability. You know, having that sober partner or sober buddy that you can text or talk to. And then giving yourself a time limit, say, okay, I'm out of here in, you know, 45 minutes, 90 minutes, 60 minutes, something like that. So those are great, great techniques that are concrete. You can physically do them, and it's not a kind of abstract idea that you have to deal with. So I like both of those very much.
Yeah.
So when you get into situations like this, do you ever find it difficult, like if you're with a friend or somebody who wants to drink, or do you play the designated driver? How do you process that? What do you go through in that kind of situation?
Sorry, could you repeat the question one more time? I had a call waiting and I ignored it.
Okay, so if you're with somebody, or you go with a group of friends to a party, and, you know, they're all – you know, how do you deal with that as far as not drinking? I mean, I know I've done it lots, and I'm always, oh, I'm the designated driver, so I'm not drinking tonight. I make sure I drive. What are some of the tricks you use with when you go with your friends?
Yeah, so here's the thing about your friends. If they're your friends, they should absolutely know that you don't drink,
right.
Because that's what friends are, you know. And
right. They
will probably respect that. With that being said, everyone loves a designated driver. I mean, I'm a city girl, so I would be more of like a designated hailing someone a cab person. But I think everyone loves a designated driver. Like, you can either, you know, have that be your good deed for the night, or you can keep that little favor that they owe you in your back pocket and whip it out whenever. But, you know, again, I really think if you're out with your friends, that if they are your friends, they already understand. And chances are, you know, hopefully if you're sober and you're going to a party, you know, I'll speak about my experience. I found that the people who are my friends, who've been my friends for years, even if they're not sober, they just aren't super heavy drinkers. So it's never a problem. I've never been in a situation where I've parted ways with a friend or with friends and they've had more than a drink or two. And it just worked out that way. Like, I didn't pick them out that way. I didn't monitor what they were drinking. I always tell people, don't mind me, like, do as you would normally do. And it's really interesting the kind of people that we start to attract when we start to change. It's kind of just law of the universal pull, which is not a term that I just made
exactly.
it on.
Well, I know, you know, over the years, I have been designated driver for countless bachelor parties. And I can say that not one person was arrested for public intox because I was able to be there. Not one person had a DUI because I made sure everybody got home. This was long before, I mean, this started long before Uber and all the social ride sharing stuff. And in fact, we have some amazing pictures because we've actually, been visited by police officers because there was a big crowd of people. And one person being sober and managing everything, the police officers were amazing. And, you know, they took pictures with the groom and all that kind of stuff and made it look, I mean, it was classy. And we had a good time. And to this day, when I talk to them, that's one of the things they talk about, how, you know, they had a safe but really, you know, crazy time, but it was safe because somebody was there who was holding everybody in kind of check and making sure things were there. So I think your friends will start to develop a respect for that, even if they don't think you shouldn't not be drinking kind of thing. You know, I mean, there's lots of advantages for having that person there. And that's very important. And, you know, doing what I do now in the forensic, I mean, I've seen DUI cases where, you know, it's cost people upwards of $70,000 to fight the DUI cases. And it's just not worth it. It really isn't. So having those say no techniques is very beneficial.
For sure. And also, just to throw it in there, you know, pictures are such a huge part of our culture now, and you know, chances are, unless you're really wilding out, you're not going to end up with like lipstick on your white blazer or smeared runny mascara or like falling all over the place in photos. You know, you're not going to wake up and you're like, you're going to look great. Like the whole
right. Time. Exactly.
Especially in the photos. You're not going to wake up and be like, oh no, what am I tagged in on Facebook? You're going to know exactly every picture you took, and you're going to, you know, your dry cleaning bill is going to go down. There's no scary surprises of scrolling through your text. There's no, you know, fake connections with people. You know, when you drink, oh, all of a sudden by the end of the night, you met someone and you can't believe that you met your soulmate, BFF forever. And it's not real, right? That's not a real connection. So it's nice to connect with people. And, you know, lastly, you're not just a designated driver. Like if you do live in a city where you're taking public transportation or an Uber, you can come and go as you please. And like you said, not get arrested for it or risk your life or get hurt. You know, it's nice to keep others safe, but you're also keeping yourself safe, which is really important.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm going to kind of use that as a segue because another thing you've written about, I know in Teen Vogue, you did social media anxiety disorder. And you talked about that, and that is a real issue. I mean, it may be more than just waking up in the morning going, oh, my God, you know, I told everybody this was my soulmate. So kind of go through that for me. What is social media anxiety disorder?
Absolutely. You know, it's a real thing, and it's so prevalent. You know, I wrote about it for Teen Vogue, but there is really, it's so prevalent among adults too, especially in the past year. And I think we all know what I mean by that. There's such an influx. We were not built as human beings. We didn't evolve to consume this amount of information or be so concerned with creating a personal brand. Even if you're a 15-year-old in like one of the flyover states, okay, like everyone now has to worry about what people, how they look, people are looking at them, what do they think of them, and presenting this life that they want the world to know. And on the other side of that, there's the fear of missing out. And then there's this influx of horrifying information. I mean, I got into positive journalism, which I write about things that are, you know, positive, inspiring, hopeful, the social good. Yes, there are things that, like, obviously we can't have most of these actually good things and people trying to change the world without a need for change, but there is so much upsetting information, and most of us get it. Even if we turn off the news, even if we don't read the newspaper, we get it from social media. And these were sites that were people posted their baby pictures or inspiring quotes. And now everyone has an opinion. People stop talking to each other. Like family members will talk to people are blogging each other. Every other story is something political and upsetting. So it's a real thing. It's a real thing. It affects on a daily basis. It really affects our mood. It triggers certain fears and insecurities on a personal level. You might be so afraid of what ends up on social media, even if you're not doing anything questionable, that you might avoid interacting with people. You might be afraid to even take a picture because you're worried about how it's going to look and not having control over that situation. You know, it's so insidious because it's so risky to compare yourself to others. And that's a lot of what we do is we are measuring our value in likes and loves and retweets and Instagram, you know, views and things like that. And that's a really slippery slope, especially because everyone is putting forth their best or their most photoshopped in some cases.
Right.
Self. And so this creates a whole other level of fear and worry.
And that's very devastating because you know your whole life. And when all you see of your friends on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, all these are these amazing things that they're doing and going through. You don't see their downs. You don't see their lows. You don't see their everyday. You see the exceptional. And that is such an unrealistic expectation. We used to get upset about Barbie dolls and what image are they sending people. Well, look at what you're getting every single day, every moment on social media. And definitely causing people to react in you know, anxious ways, to lack of a better explanation. And it's disturbing. It is. How do you compete? How do you compare?
It's wild. I mean, people stress over writing the perfect thing, right, to someone else, and they craft this response, and then they get upset if it's not returned, and that can affect your relationship in real life or how you feel about someone, you know, or there's this fear of what happens if I'm not on my phone or on social, monitoring everything that could possibly be said about me or posted about me or getting the messages. You know, when I was a teenager, I had several issues, and a core theme was, you know, if someone did, this is just when we had text and like Facebook, you had to have a college email to register. So I can't believe that's old fashioned. Oh my gosh. But, I would think that everything was, I read into absences. Like if I texted someone and they didn't text me back, it was, oh, they're ignoring me. They're not really my friend. Right? That's what I was thinking when I was 16, 17, 18. Really, it might just be that person is doing what we all should do, which is taking a break from their phone for a little while or just doing something else, or they just got distracted and forgot. But people are reading into these silences, and people are also feeling this need to control and to be present, to, you know, feel like they have some sort of handle on the situation. And the truth is, on the internet can be a crazy place, and no matter how much you check in, it's not going to stop the avalanche from, you know, rolling down the hill no matter what you do. And I think, you know, it's so important not to measure your self-worth in likes and tweets and stuff. I mean, I've had those moments where I post an article that I feel is really important and like two people will like it. And meanwhile, someone else in my newsfeed posted like an essay about why people, like everyone should stop being mean to her about her divorce. And it gets like 750 likes. And I'm like, really? But I can't like go down that path because never try to understand the internet is my number one rule, you know? And
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, I'm glad you're saying that because, you know, there's actually articles out there that everybody has time to text. So if they're not responding, it's because they're doing it on purpose, you know? And it's like, what is this stuff? And they're, I mean, page after page, story after story like that, and blogs and posts and everything else talking about, oh, they're just ignoring you. There's something wrong with this, you know. And I'm like, they need to get over themselves,
yeah.
Really. I think that, I mean, you used to leave a voice message on somebody's answering machine. Remember those days we had actually tape recorders for that? I'm dating myself. And, you know, you might not hear from somebody for 2 weeks, but they eventually call you back, you know, maybe longer. But that's just the way life is. I mean, if you're having a life, you don't have time to respond instantly. Well, I do
yeah.
want to respect your time, and I know we're kind of running up against the deadline. I'd like to give you a minute to talk about your book that's coming out and then talk about your website. And
but the book has been out for about a year and a half.
About a year. Okay. Well, I mean, 911, a girl's journey through darkness to a new beginning. It sounds kind of like what we're talking about here, combining these two and your experiences. So, it's still apropos and appropriate for today.
Absolutely. Yeah. So After 9/11 is a memoir that I wrote about my experience literally surviving 9/11 as a 12-year-old who was in middle school a
wow.
couple of blocks away from the World Trade Center and who lived 3 blocks away from the World Trade Center on the other side of town. So if you think about it as a circle with the World Trade Center in the middle, and you draw a straight line through it, that's so what happened was that day I actually, in trying to get home, got caught in everything that was happening at the base of the towers and continued to live in what became a war zone for 2 weeks, which turned into really 6 months. It was like a whole other world. And I grew up with all sorts of issues, and I kept going to different psychiatrists and therapists and specialists trying to figure out
wow.
quote unquote, what was wrong with me and trying to fix it. And I got all these different diagnoses and took all these medications that made me sick. And I went to 3 different high schools and I was getting worse. And it kind of was almost re-traumatizing in a way because I kept trusting these professionals to help me. And I wanted so badly to get better. And it was rough. And so the good thing is that on my last kind of hope, I found the right therapist, which was a cognitive behavioral therapist. And then I did DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. And then
right.
I got sober, and it was, hey, you know, no one thought post-traumatic stress disorder, which has some, you know, overlapping with other, you know, DSM diagnoses, some
things right.
here and there, but primarily PTSD. And really, it's about rebuilding my life, because I feel like in so many books or movies or stories or TV shows, like the horrible traumatic thing happens and then everyone's fine. And it's like, well, no, that's not how it works. And not only that, but I wanted to show people, you know, the story doesn't end with, and then I got better. Like, here's exactly what it was like for me, you know, and here's what might strike a chord with you. And I thought it was really important to see it all the way through to like the new beginning and rebuilding a self and rebuilding a life and, you know, holding on to hope, because it is possible. And really that is what led me to the career path that I have now, because I knew I wanted to be a journalist and a writer since I was little. And people started to ask me, well, what are you going to do in this industry? Because all the news is going to be triggering for you. It's terrifying and scary and wars. And I'm like, I'm not going to cover that. And so I've worked really hard, really, really hard, because it's a niche and it's not, you know, the most lucrative, you know, covering nonprofits and social good and things. But I never gave up on that either. And I've been able
Good.
To kind of carve out a place for myself in that space too. So all of my articles and information about the book and all that good stuff is at my website, which is just my name, HelenaHovitz.com.
And I think it's an amazing website. I mean, I've perused it, and like I told you earlier off the air, it felt like I was going through a blog. There's just so much information there, and it's all good and relevant. It's not like you're talking about, oh, well, for dinner tonight, I had lasagna, and, you know, none of
yeah.
that kind of
it's
stuff.
It's all published articles. So they've all appeared in, like, Vice or Teen Vogue or somewhere. I've written for over 50 different publications, so
yeah.
it's a lot. But it's,
And it's all good. I mean, I actually started, like, okay, well, let's see if there's – I can find an article that I don't agree with, and I couldn't. It's like, wow, that's so cool. So, and I can't say that about most other websites and like that. So you've done a really amazing job, and I really, really am glad you came on. Like I said, you know, when Ryan McCormick started talking to me about, hey, I want you to check out this person, I'm like, oh my God, I've got to have her on my
show. Thank you.
So you're
thank you.
You're,
it's been such a pleasure. I'm really excited.
And then, you know, you're sitting there like, hey, I'm 28. And I'm like, oh my God, I would have, just from what you've done, I'm like, she's got to be mid 40s, something like that. And it's like, you have such a career in front of you. I can just see it. I can't wait to just keep reading about yourself. So
thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming on our show. And, remember, you need to go and check out her website, HelenaHovitz.com. She has links to her book. You can purchase it right there. Amazing stories throughout the whole thing. You won't be dissatisfied. You will be quite pleased, I think. And there's something there for everybody, regardless of your age. You don't have to be teen to enjoy these articles and learn something from them. So thank you for coming on the show, Helena.
Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Well, that concludes our show today with Helena Hovitz. And I want to remind everybody, you're listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. Please follow our website at mainstreammentalhealth.org. You can check us out at Mainstream Mental Health Radio on Google or on any of our social media links. We've got links to our radio shows. Please follow us. Thank you for coming to our show. And remember, life is what happens while you're making plans, so buckle up.
Thanks for listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber. Check us out on social media, Google+, Mainstream Mental Health, Instagram, @ Mainstream Mental Health, Twitter, @ Mainstream MENTL, and search for Mainstream Mental Health on Facebook. Please tune in every week to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber.